Okay, I'd like to thank our three presenters for excellent presentations. And I'll ask the first question, and then we'll throw it out to the audience. It seems like we always have to, whenever you go to a forum and people who are interested in international affairs are there, they're always, the discussion always seems to stray from what is the actual threat to the U.S. We say, oh, Iran's going to get nuclear weapons, or oh, North Korea's going to get nuclear weapons. And since the U.S. is the superpower, everyone expects that the threat seems to be very vague, and we seem to the threat lacks specificity, and therefore we seem to think that just because they do get nuclear weapons, they're a threat to the U.S. Now, our speakers have sort of been more specific, but I'd like to draw out one thing. It seems from the presentations that the major threat to the U.S. of these countries getting nuclear weapons is not that they're going to launch a nuclear attack against the United States, because we have a lot more warheads. We have thousands of warheads, and they'll have a few warheads. Our warheads we have command and control over them. They may not have very good command and control over theirs. So our system works a lot better than theirs will. So that may not be the biggest threat. It seems that the biggest threat is that they will either sell or give these weapons to terrorist groups. And I'm just wondering, it seems as if the state of trade, now the one way to deter that is, of course, to know where, to be able to trace this back. So if a terrorist group gets a weapon, blows it up on U.S. soil, we can determine who gave it to them. Now, in the case of North Korea, I think we have a good idea, although I'm going to throw this over to Doug and then to Trita. To what extent can we trace nuclear material from Iran and North Korea in case they would give it to a terrorist group? And the fact that you could trace it would be a deterrent for them to do that in the first place, because they would then face the wrath of the U.S. nuclear arsenal on their soil. Doug, you want to go first?
Sure. Strikes me that the primary American interest involved in North Korean nuclear proliferation is proliferation, that is, further proliferation to non-state actors. We clearly can deter the North Koreans from acting directly against us. The other interest clearly is a question of America's allies, particularly so long as we have a nuclear umbrella, then we're involved. So if you imagine a situation where the U.S. promises to use nuclear weapons to defend South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Australia, I don't know, whoever else we want to throw into the package, and the North Koreans have a nuclear weapon, then we have managed to get ourselves in the middle of a rather potentially unstable, messy situation. Even though I still don't think the North is likely to use them against its neighbors, we've suddenly kind of created a separate issue for ourselves that I think implicates our interest. But that's because of a nuclear umbrella as opposed to North Korean developments directly. I mean, obviously, any tracing, any attempt to, what goes on an airplane, what goes on a ship, can things get sent out, is going to be imperfect. I think the critical thing to emphasize is they could never be certain of getting away from it, getting away with it. And if they attempted it and we found it, that the regime would fall. That I think these are, that if you give them an alternative way to make money, that is, you enter into the international economy and you do a number of other things, you can take care of yourselves, and you say if you try to raise money this way, the penalty of failure is very, very high. I'd prefer to have them not have nuclear weapons. But I think I would rely on deterrence that way, that they'd have to understand if they are found out, the penalty would be exceptional.
Well, I understand after their nuclear test, Bush made a pretty direct threat to them that if they did cross the red line and they did give it to any other nation or
And they've indicated
group,
they understand that. Their rhetoric, they've distinguished between having an arsenal and providing it to others.
Right, and I understand after the inspectors were in there for a while that you can, North Korea, they have a library of that they can trace. Right. I'm not sure about Iran. What about Iran on that? Do you know anything about how much of a library the U.S. has on their nuclear material?
I don't think much, but at the same time, I would say a couple of things that makes this scenario quite unlikely. One, the Israelis have already signaled Iran that any terrorist attack with WMDs, chemical, biological, and nuclear, that would take place against Israel will immediately retaliate against Iran. Even during the Lebanon war last year, the Israelis signaled that any attack by long-range missiles from Hezbollah on Israel against cities south of Haifa would lead to an Israeli retaliation against Iran. No long-distance missile was used by Hezbollah against Israel, even though Nasrallah had promised that he would do it. And this was seen by people in Israel as effective deterrence against Tehran. So I think the Iranians, much like the other regimes there, they have a tremendous amount of problems. This is not an easy government to deal with. More than anything, it's mistreating its own people worse than anyone else. But this is not a suicidal regime. If they were suicidal, they would have committed suicide in the past 28 years. They haven't. On the contrary, they have achieved probably a stronger position now than ever before. That's hardly the track record of a suicidal state.
Okay, I think we'll open it up to the audience here. And please wait for the microphone and then state your name and your affiliation. We'll go with Marie right over here.
Helps if the moderator knows who you are.
Hi, thank you, Ivan. I'm Marie Rietman. I'm with Women's Action for New Directions. So I'm interested in the panelists' thoughts on what is most doable in Congress today to help prevent a military strike on Iran.
Anyone like to take that one?
I think Congress can play a very critical role, primarily by not standing in the way of diplomacy. Right now, the Bush administration, after 6 years, have finally made a rather important decision, which is to talk to the Iranians in Iraq about Iraq. Obviously, diplomacy on such a narrow issue is unlikely to succeed unless it is broadened. But there are many, many threats to this very, very fragile process of diplomacy right now. One of them is coming from the hardliners inside of Iran, who seem to have been motivated to arrest these four Iranian-American scholars precisely to poison the atmosphere and make it more difficult for diplomacy to succeed. This is a pattern that we've seen in Tehran in the past. Whenever there's been an opportunity for diplomacy between the United States and Iran, some elements in Iran who fear that, who prefer the status quo, have taken rather radical actions in order to make it as difficult as possible. Congress is currently considering various sanctions acts, same sanctions that have been imposed in the past that have not been successful. But under these circumstances, when diplomacy has taken its first small steps, to impose sanctions in the middle of that can very likely have the effect of causing another major threat or undermining effort against this very fragile diplomatic process. So right now, perhaps Congress should do nothing. And keep in mind that the Democratic majority in Congress right now was actually elected to prevent or stop the war in Iraq. That would probably expand also to making sure that another war is not started.
Okay.
Yeah, hi, my name is Kenneth Rothschild. I'm just independent. I'm not representing an organization. I think that we're stuck in a model of the past. Although the panel did an excellent job, you brought out a lot of points. The point I want to get to and see what the panel thinks is that we have to remodel our thinking. First of all, we've relied on the nation state and the leadership too much. And the nation state sometimes separates from the interest of the people and the population, one thing. Two, I think, and I just use this as an example, if we had spent the same amount of money we have on the defense in the Middle East, on Israel and so forth, on co-development projects between different groups of people, so where they have something at stake and they would lose something, I think we would have been much better off. Three, in the past, and this is a model of the past with kings and queens and so forth, what they used to do to protect each other is they used to intermarry. They used to send their children here and send their children there. I think we have to intermingle our populations throughout the world so that when somebody thinks of bombing somebody else, they're thinking of bombing some of their own people, be it their children or whatever. So the point I'm getting at is that the presentation is excellent because we're at a terrible point now where we really have to rethink. And I don't have all the solutions, but what I'm saying is, can we get out of this box to move forward, because nuclear proliferation is a reality now, and we have to accept that and move on with it.
Okay, we have mentioned some things, our speakers have mentioned some things that we could do besides simply deterrent. For instance, helping these countries, maybe even in secret, work on their safety and security specifics. It was mentioned rendered safe. If the Musharraf regime fell, if the Iranian regime fell, if the North Korean regime fell, and they had nuclear weapons, how could they be able to render the weapons safe so that no one would, no group or individual would get a hold of the weapons? Also, improving their security of the weapons. Doug mentioned diplomatic relations, reintegrating these countries into the world politically and economically. And I think Trita was mentioning that as well, that perhaps sanctions are isolating these regimes is not the way to go. And the third line was the red line on proliferation. Are there any other ways that we could, is there anything else we could do if these countries get nuclear weapons that would help out along the reintegration lines that this gentleman is making the point?
Well, I think in general that economic sanctions are a problem because they prevent private consensual contact below the level of government. I certainly agree that at times governments don't represent their societies very well. I think the challenge is there are no easy answers on this sort of thing. Governments go to war. Nationalism is very powerful. I mean, look at China. Nationalism is very strong in China. You know, the people of China are probably more nationalistic and at times have been more antagonistic to the U.S. than their government has. I mean, during the EP3 incident, for example, to the extent we could measure popular opinion, it certainly appeared the spy plane when it came down in April of 2001. You know, to the extent we can measure popular opinion, the Chinese people seem to be irritated that their government was taking too soft a line with the United States. So even kind of private person-to-person stuff doesn't always work. And while, you know, I appreciate the idea of, like, intermingling populations, you know, in World War I, Kaiser Wilhelm ended up at war against his cousin, you know, Tsar Nicholas, and his uncle, you know, the king in Britain. So, I mean, there were a lot of intermarriages, in Europe prior to World War I, and they still went off into a slugfest, killed 16 million people, ruined the continent, set the stages for another war. So we have kind of an eternal challenge, I think, here of dealing with war and peace, nationalism, and a lot of other things.
Okay. What about this gentleman right here?
Thank you. I'm Don Herr from the Center for International Policy. One question that I wanted maybe to get a little more on is this whole identification of a nuke that might be given to terrorists. I think the problem is wider than just a nuke. AK Khan, for example, just provided a lot of technology, a lot of assistance on how to build a nuke. And the more nuke powers we have, the more this kind of expertise is likely to filter down to terrorist groups. Maybe they already have it. Maybe they're already getting it on the internet. But I think we're a little bit too complacent about, well, let's accept more powers. We don't have to worry about terrorists taking advantage of it. And another point is more specific on North Korea and the suggestion that maybe we should be promoting more nuclear powers in Asia, like Japan and South Korea, and take away the umbrella. I think that would be a very dangerous move, and that we ought to be thinking rather of some kind of creative new agreement, say, with Tokyo and Korea, South Korea, to give them a more confidence in our nuclear umbrella, perhaps beef it up, but not take it away. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think I'll let Chuck deal with the first part, maybe Doug deal with the second part. Go ahead.
I don't think any of us are necessarily suggesting we shouldn't worry about countries potentially leaking material or technology to terrorist groups. I just don't think it's necessarily the conventional wisdom, doom and gloom picture that is often painted for us. There's some good news here. I mean, despite all that AQ Khan did, the reality is it's really hard for a bunch of guys sitting in a dark room in some musty apartment in wherever part of the world to build a nuclear weapon. I mean, you look at what it takes to build a nuclear weapon. It takes a pretty decent infrastructure to build. I mean, you know, you have to be a somewhat developed country devoting, you know, lots and lots of resources. I mean, the bigger fear is just that, you know, terrorists get their hands on a ready-made weapon, not that they have, you know, get their hands on the technology. I mean, you can go on the web probably and find out at least enough to engineering-wise. And it's just science. You know, and the bottleneck is material, finding whether it's highly enriched uranium or weapons grade plutonium to build an actual weapon. And so, sort of the good news is that it's hard for, you know, a small group of guys or women, for that matter, to build a weapon completely on their own without state aid and without access to the kind of infrastructure that countries have to build these things. So. Yes, we need to be concerned, but I think the question is how you put that concern in perspective, and then what policies you put in place to prevent things from happening that you don't want to happen. I think the important thing to emphasize is that, you know, part of this discussion is you know, you raised the question of nuclear forensics and the like. Trying to trace back whether from detonation or you believe that there's a loose nuke somewhere is a needle in the haystack. Type effort. The only way you will find out is sheer dumb luck. Okay, that's the reality of it. So the best thing you possibly can do, and where you should put most of your efforts, is stopping it at the source. We're doing that with Russia and the former Soviet Union, and for the first time, some states outside of the former Soviet states with cooperative threat reduction. I think we have, you know, in terms of thinking creatively, what are the things we can do that we're doing in cooperative threat reduction that might apply to regimes like Pakistan, North Korea, possibly even Iran? That requires very creative thinking, because you're talking about how would you cooperate, in at least in the case of North Korea and Iran, with countries where their regimes don't exactly like us and we don't exactly like them. But can we find some common ground that makes sense for both? And I think that's, to the extent that we have to be prepared for the failure of nonproliferation efforts, that's what we have to begin to focus on.
Am I wrong, but Khan sold his technology, I believe, to nation to governments rather than groups, right?
Well,
people in governments tend to do what they do with other people in governments rather than to the groups. That's not to say it's impossible that he could have sold it to terrorists, but I think there even people who are doing these types of things kind of recognize the dangers of doing that. Okay, Doug, the second part of the question.
No, I recognize it to suggest that perhaps we should accept further proliferation can cause cardiac arrest. Let me suggest the problem is, you know, what is our underlying assumption? Is it that nonproliferation is the highest goal or that American security is the highest goal? To my mind, we cannot assume that a priori nonproliferation is necessarily the highest goal. So maybe it is, but we have to sit down, think about it, think it through. In some cases, I think proliferation is inevitable. I don't believe there's anything we could have done to India or Pakistan to stop that train once it started moving. And I think we probably set ourselves back with a relationship with India by penalizing them to stop them from building weapons that they were not, I mean, for lots of reasons, both China and Pakistan most obviously, they were going to build. And I guess my thought experiment would be, would it make sense for the U.S. to go tomorrow to both New Delhi and Islamabad and say, well, I'll tell you guys what, if you give up your bombs, we'll offer a nuclear guarantee to each of you. Would we want to do that? Would we want to put the United States on the line in terms of guaranteeing the security of both of those countries, which have enormous, you know, kind of difficulties with each other? I think my reaction is to say, no, thank you. I mean, I'd want to stay out as opposed to get in. And I would just post, you know, I would posit for East Asia, imagine the year 2020, 2030, let us assume, and I hope this doesn't happen, but let us assume a nationalistic, aggressive PRC. I mean, one which I think some folks, people who write books like Showdown, you know, Coming War with China and what have you, seem to think. I mean, there's a lot of that out there. So let us posit an aggressive nationalistic PRC, a nationalistic fascistic Russia, and as usual, kind of an unstable, poor, messy North Korea. They are the only ones who have nuclear weapons in East Asia. And the U.S. is expected to ensure against them South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, Australia, I don't know, throw in Thailand perhaps, and Philippines, and I don't know, whoever else. Do we want the U.S. to put the full faith and credit of its own cities, such as Los Angeles, on the line to ensure that the Taiwanese don't go and declare independence and get the Chinese mad and the Chinese will decide we won't defend them? Do we want to make sure we're going to guarantee if the Chinese start shooting at the Filipinos over the Spratly Islands? Any number of things. So I simply throw that out, that you know, a nuclear umbrella is not costless. It is risky. So we need to debate whether that risk is greater or lesser than other options out there, including proliferation among democratic allies. I'm not saying that that is necessarily a good solution, but it's not clear to me that our current policy is a good one either.
I always thought it was interesting that even during the Cold War, when the Soviets had a big tank army in Europe, that I always wondered, our policy was essentially if the tank army comes, we're going nuclear first, it could escalate, and we're putting our cities. So as bad as the Soviets invading Europe was, I think it would have been worse if we were going on the idea that we'll never have to honor this commitment. We do this all the time. We've expanded NATO. We'll never have to honor. It's just a political thing. But sometimes the cost of that can be pretty high. The other thing is political. Some political scientists say that the more nuclear weapon states than we now have might be more stable. So this is not a half-cocked opinion at all. Right here.
I'm Diane Perlman. I'm a social scientist, and I study cycles of violence, nuclear proliferation, and terrorism. And I think one of the reasons it doesn't seem like there are good answers is because we're operating in a paradigm that has no end game and provokes escalation, and that we seem that by threats, coercion, and even rewards and punishment, which creates unintended consequences, also increases fear, humiliation, which increase cycles of violence. And even deterrence is not reliable. Sometimes it breaks down. It works best when it's accompanied by drastic tension reduction. And you also have spiral theory, so we sort of have a combination of spiraling deterrence. What Trita mentioned, the freeze by freeze, I think is a step in the right direction. In terms of being creative, I think it also relying on sound principles from conflict studies of what reduces tension reduction is an organizing principle. And also the grand bargain are consistent with a strategy known as GRIT, which people may be familiar with, graduated reciprocated initiatives in tension reduction, which starts with a unilateral initiative that reduces tension. And I guess my last point is that proliferation is inevitable as long as the United States doesn't abide by Article 6 of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, that as long as we have our nuclear weapons, we have to sort of look at the effect that we have on countries around the world and
paranoia. I want to draw out your last point with the panelists here. To what extent, if we reduced our the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, we're not really arguing this, honoring the spirit of it ourselves. To what extent would reductions in our own nuclear forces be at least somewhat of a incentive for other countries not to adopt these weapons?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, it's certainly an honorable goal, a nuclear-free world. I mean, I think most people would agree that might be a better world than we live in today. We can't get there. That's not the real world, and there are reasons why countries are going to always have incentives to acquire nuclear weapons. And in fact, I raise in the paper the sort of pragmatic question: if the United States chose to disarm itself, as did the other nuclear powers, who's going to enforce, the freeze? I mean, what happens when somebody cheats? The cheater then suddenly has the upper hand, once they have weapons and you don't. So, I mean, there are real practical considerations to the United States' ability to honor the NPT. And in fact, I think the NPT is a false bargain. It's worse than trying to sell somebody the Brooklyn Bridge. Why would any country agree not to develop nuclear weapons that doesn't have them now in exchange for the United States and the other nuclear powers giving up something that they already have? I mean, that defies common sense. Nobody in their right mind would enter into that kind of bargain. The NPT is sort of like gun control. Law-abiding citizens, law-abiding countries obey the law under the NPT. It's the outliers that you have to worry about, and they're not going to obey the law no matter what how you structure the treaty. So we've just got to deal with that reality. It might help if we reduced our arsenal. At least it would be an act of good faith. But given the current environment, again, I think regimes say no. either I need them or I don't need them, and they have reasons for them, not just not that the United States behaved in a particular way.
Anybody have a question on Iran? Oh, right here.
Brian Bender with the Boston Globe. Several of you talked about grand bargains, but also the importance of deterrence. I'm wondering your view on how do you make a grand bargain to a country like Iran right now without undercutting your deterrence at the same time? Don't you need to show the stick, at least in some aspect? And how do you do that without marching towards war, without creating more instability? I mean, we all know that, or we've seen the reports that Iran is aiding insurgents in Iraq that are killing American troops. If you offered a grand bargain now, don't you completely undercut your deterrence? Or don't you need to rattle the saber somewhat so that they will actually agree to a bargain?
Let's let Sreedha begin.
I don't think anyone would have suggested that you completely get rid of your stick. The problem right now is that all we have is the stick. It's not so that if there was a real offer to have comprehensive talks that would undermine the stick in any way, shape, or form. The stick is there. Everyone knows it. I don't think the United States needs to prove it every 5 seconds. It's there. The major problem right now, though, with focusing so much on the stick is that there's such a tremendous amount of distrust between the two countries. So even when an offer for negotiation is being made, both sides see that solely as a tactical maneuver in order to wield the stick later on and exercise the stick. So the more we continue to think that if we're not constantly talking about the military action, we come across as weak, we're actually undermining our ability to be able to have credibility when we truly want diplomacy.
I think, just if I could just add, I think especially in today's context, that where I think force has been used almost frivolously in Iraq, I mean, without planning, without consideration of consequences, we certainly want to think very carefully before threatening. That's certainly one aspect, I think, of the discussion on Iran, is we need to be more careful because, frankly, the debacle in Iraq and the way I think force was misused there.
Do we really have negotiating hand with Iran anymore? It seems like Iran now holds most of the cards in this. They can disrupt our operations in Iraq, kill our people. We're in a pretty weak position now vis-a-vis, where we were before, right?
True. I think compared to where we were before, clearly the Iranians are in a better position now. But the lesson we should learn is, what is the cost of delay? When the United States was in a very, very strong position and the Iranians were in a rather weak position, the Bush administration chose not to negotiate. The argument now is we want to get back to that situation in which we're stronger and the Iranians are weaker before we negotiate. The problem is that while we're trying to do so, we're actually making the military option the most likely option to succeed. We're undermining diplomacy. And at the end of the day, we have to remember, even though Iran is in a stronger position today than it was 3 years ago, the U.S. has weakened itself. The U.S. is still the world's sole superpower. Iran is still a third world country. Let's not forget that.
Okay, I have to cut it off here. I promised our speakers that we would be out of here by 12:30 and into the refreshment phase. So I invite you all to join us for refreshments afterwards. And thanks for coming, and thanks for our speakers. It was a fun.
Next thing you know, you're